Case number two, which is Maldonado versus the Baker County Sheriff's Office, 20-12605. I see that we have, I'm going to ask your indulgence, Ms. Baranowski, score. Ms. Baranowski here for the appellants, and Mr. Carson here for the appellees. Ms. Baranowski, whenever you're ready, no hurry.
May it please the court, Elise Baranowski for plaintiff's appellants, Hamza Maldonado and James Hill. Mr. Maldonado and Mr. Hill filed an action in Florida State Court alleging serious violations of their federal and state constitutional rights to free exercise of religion. Rather than litigate these claims in Florida State Court, defendants chose to remove this case to federal court and paid the federal filing fee. While everyone agrees that defendants were required to and did pay the federal filing fee upon removal, the district court found that Mr. Maldonado's claims could not proceed unless he paid the federal filing fee, citing 28 U.S.C. section 1915G. As the Tenth Circuit squarely concluded in Woodson, nothing in section 1915G justifies that result. This section, by its plain language, applies when a prisoner brings a civil action or appeal under this section, that is, under section 1915, the federal IFP statute. But Mr. Maldonado has not done that here. Where defendants brought this case into federal court and paid the filing fee, section 1915G does not provide some freestanding basis for dismissing a prisoner's suit. And the district court's basis for dismissing Mr. Hill's claims is equally unsound. The unanimous Supreme Court in Jones v. Bach made clear that plaintiffs, like Mr. Hill, have absolutely no obligation to plead exhaustion, as it is an affirmative defense that defendants must plead and prove. Here, Mr. Hill's pro se statement on exhaustion, which again was not required, is not crystal clear. But because it is possible to read Mr. Hill's complaint as consistent with exhaustion, and defendants don't contest that it's possible, defendants could not rely on the complaint alone to prove that they were entitled to their affirmative defense. Defendants are free to make other arguments on remand, but the arguments in their motion to dismiss, the arguments before this court today, do not suffice to hand them a victory at this early stage. We respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's order of dismissal and remand for further proceedings.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? Isn't really the crux of the case here fall on what the definition of the word bring means?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And this court has spoken to the definition of the word bring. In Harris v. Garner, this court sitting on bonk said that the words bring a civil action or appeal in section 1915G have been held to mean the filing of a suit or appeal, not its continuation. And in White v. Lemma, this court interpreted the next load-bearing phrase in the statute under this section, and it said that under this section means under section 1915's grant of IFP status. And the only circuits to address this issue agree. The Tenth Circuit in Woodson said that state court plaintiffs whose cases are removed to federal court have no obligation to pay a filing fee, and nothing in the federal IFP statute is to the contrary. In the Ninth Circuit in Harris v. Mangum, addressing a related issue, also noted that section 1915G does not prevent an indigent prisoner plaintiff with three strikes from proceeding in a case that someone else has filed in federal court. And recently in Hill v. Madison County, Judge Easterbrook, interpreting section 1915G, noted that language sets limits, and bring means to commence something, not to prosecute it. If there are no further questions on section 1915G, Your Honors, I would like to speak to the matter of exhaustion. Here, Mr. Hill said in the complaint that there is no grievance remedy for Mr. Hill because the denial at issue is absolute. We know what he was trying to say. He was trying to say that he exhausted. At docket number 19, page 2, Mr. Hill said that he exhausted all remedies just like Mr. Maldonado. And in docket number 23, page 2, he said that he did in fact exhaust his remedies. So this is an affirmative defense, Your Honors, and This court, when addressing an affirmative defense, does not find it on the face of the complaint unless it's clear beyond a doubt from the complaint itself that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts which would avoid the defense. And that's simply not clear on this language, Your Honor. And I would note as well that this court has said, when interpreting a pro se complaint, that they are to be held to a less stringent standard and liberally construed. So if there is any uncertainty to that language, I would keep in mind as well that this was, that Mr. Hill was proceeding pro se at that point. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you so much. Mr. Carson, you've got 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You might want to start with Judge Lagoa's question about the plain meaning of the word bring.
Absolutely. May it please the court, my name is Matt Carson. I represent the Baker County Sheriff's Office, Scotty Roden and Evelyn Blue, the appellees in this action. There's no easy way to address your question, Judge Lagoa, except to say that I don't see a lot of consistency in the way that courts have addressed how to define bring and how to define brought. They've done it definitively, but it's not been done consistently. When, and the most recent case would be Hill versus Madison County, where Judge Easterbrook.
But isn't the usual definition of bring means to commence an action in the legal world?
Well, I would agree with you, except when we look at the way that courts have handled it, when it's useful to the court to get to a resolution, they'll point to Black's Law Dictionary and say commence means to file. But when you look at the Hill versus Madison County case, Judge Easterbrook says that defendants brought it to federal court under 1441A, but section 1915G does not apply to complaints brought to federal court by defendants. Well, I don't know that the defendants commenced a legal action by removing it. It'd still be a situation where the plaintiffs commenced the legal action by filing it.
But the remainder of the section, it's not just, I think you're right that the plaintiffs here brought an action. But the section, the statute says brought an action under this section. They didn't bring an action under this section. They brought an action under some provision of state law.
Well, so to get to that point, I think it's important for the court to look at the overarching goal, the overarching purpose that Congress had in mind when it passed the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
Woof. All right, so are you sort of forsaking the text in favor of goals and purposes?
I would never suggest doing such a thing. I think both positions, appellee's position and appellant's position, requires a slight stretch of the language. The cases that have looked at other issues in the PLRA and in 1915 specifically, where they've had to look at what does bring mean, what has brought mean, doesn't really help this court. Certainly doesn't help my client's position. I'll acknowledge that.
But when you're bringing an action under this section, you're bringing an action, and you're filing it in forma pauperis, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
When a defendant usually brings an action under this particular section 1915. They're bringing it, as defined here, it's a proceeding in forma pauperis.
Correct. So, but what I would suggest is when a plaintiff seeks and receives in forma pauperis status in state court, and that case is then removed to federal court, they are still proceeding as an IFP or under IFP status. And that stays that way until such time as a federal court, a federal judge, has an opportunity to review that decision. And that's what happens here, and that's what happened in the other district court cases that we cited in both our motion below and in our brief here.
Well, but how do you then say, it, in this case, when you removed it under section 1914, that section requires for you to remove it that you have to file a filing fee, correct?
Correct.
So this case is no longer proceeding in forma pauperis. There is a filing fee, because that's really what it is. It's a filing fee has now been paid.
Well, Well, I would suggest this, Your Honor. The first section of 1915, A1, says, subject to subsection B, any court of the United States may authorize the commencement, prosecution, or defense of any suit. And obviously, defense wouldn't apply here. There is a reading of the word bring to include commence or prosecute. And our position is that even when the case is removed and the defendants pay a filing fee for that removal, it is still the plaintiff who is prosecuting the case. It is still the plaintiff that is bringing the civil action.
What about the provision of 1914, I think it's sub B, that says once the filing fees are paid, no more fees? So here we've got an action that, your clients coughed up $400 or whatever it was to get it going. And now the district court says, to me, it seems like in the face of sub B, I'm going to require another $400.
Right. I would say this in response to that, Your Honor, and I know you were paraphrasing. I don't think that's precisely what 1914B says. I read 1914B to be a prohibition against the clerk from coming up with other fees that the clerk wants to charge that are beyond those prescribed by the Judicial Conference of the United States.
That actually was a question that I had, because under what authority could you get more than one filing fee? Where is that filing fee going, that extra surplus going?
I'm glad you asked. The authority is under the PLRA. The PLRA requires that every prisoner litigant pay a filing fee, either up front if they're a three strikes litigant or with an interest-free loan from the government if they're not a three strikes litigant. This court in Hubbard v. Haley required multiple filing fees from multiple prisoner litigants. Now, this court also upheld a ruling that it should be multiple complaints, but in the Seventh Circuit, in Boraborn v. Berg, the court allowed multiple prisoner litigant plaintiffs to bring a single multi-plaintiff complaint, yet each one of them had to pay a filing fee. The filing fee that's required under the Prison Litigation Reform Act is not, this is my position, I don't have a court case to cite to this specific point. It's not to make sure that the clerk has enough money to administer a case that's filed with it. The purpose of the filing fee, as it relates to prisoner litigants, is to make them stop and think before they file frivolous, meritless, and sportive actions.
Well, be that as it may, how is that policy, if we're going to talk about policies, how is that policy advanced here? They didn't want to be in federal court. They're not abusing the federal court system by filing a frivolous lawsuit. They might have, maybe the lawsuit's frivolous, I have no idea, but they filed it in state court. It's for the Georgia courts to deal with. For the state courts to deal with.
Sure. Well, I mean, if he filed a state court action, then it would have remained in state court.
You brought it to federal court.
Well, you know, and that's where I don't see that in the Prison Litigation Reform Act or 1915 either. This notion that the purpose of the act is just to prevent folks from filing directly in federal court. The purpose is to reduce the number of meritless and frivolous cases.
Is that the Prison Litigation Reform Act sort of pursues this policy of reducing frivolous litigation at all costs and does so on behalf of states.
I wouldn't say, I don't know what the second part of your question.
Well, I mean, I guess there was, we know to a certainty that there was no frivolous lawsuit here filed in federal court. And so to the extent that the policy of the Prison Litigation Reform Act is to prevent the filing of frivolous lawsuits in federal court, which I would think is the only business Congress has regulating this at all, they don't have any business regulating the filing of frivolous lawsuits in state court, do they?
Sure, I would agree. But I don't know that I necessarily agree the purpose is to prevent filing in federal court. Again, I don't see that in the language of the statutes that were amended or created by the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And every court that's looked at it has said, cases cited by both sides in this litigation have said the purpose is to reduce the number of cases. Now, we had a role in getting it before the federal court, no doubt.
A role?
You had the role.
We could argue about this. The point I would suggest, though, is that if plaintiff doesn't bring a federal claim, in state court, we have no opportunity to remove. If the purpose, and every case that's looked at this.
But every litigant has a right to file a federal, if they want to file a federal claim in state court, they have the right to do so. We don't have exclusive jurisdiction over federal claims.
That's right, that's right. And if it stayed there, I wouldn't be able to make these arguments. It's my client's right to seek removal when it's beneficial to them. And in prison litigation cases specifically, we almost always take advantage of that right. And so, and in this case, as Judge Adams noted in his order.
And that's your right to remove a case, just like it's any defendant's right to remove a case, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. The point, though, is that once you do and you make that decision, it's a strategic litigation decision you've made to remove a case to federal court, you initiate and you pay a filing fee. And now you're trying to impose the three strikes rule on defendants who did not commence an action in federal court.
Plaintiffs.
Yeah, plaintiffs. Right, they didn't commence, but they certainly continued. They certainly prosecuted, and they certainly intended to bring it all the way to completion. At every
what
term,
was their, let me ask you this, what was their other path forward? They bring a claim in state court. They want to be in state court. You dragged them in federal court, and now you say that, well, they're prosecuting their action. What else are they supposed to do? You brought them to federal court. Are they supposed to just fold?
Dismiss?
Pay the filing fee.
But why?
Under what authority?
Right.
Under 1915G.
If we talked about this earlier, forgive me, but so what about the provision in 1914A that says that the filing fee is on the parties instituting any civil action, suit, or proceeding in such court, whether by original process, removal, or otherwise?
Again, I would just point to those two cases I mentioned earlier, where it talks about, you know, multiple plaintiffs, all of them prisoners. The court required, in one case, the court required 18 filing fees because there were 18 prisoner litigants. So I don't read 1914A or 1914B to necessarily limit Congress's ability to require a filing fee or multiple filing fees in addition to removal, or 18 filing fees if you have 18 prisoner litigants in a subsequent legislative act, in a subsequent congressional act, which was 1915G.
It seems to me that under 1914A, though, even in your 18 plaintiff case, those are still the parties, plural, in the statute, who instituted the civil action. So maybe that's a good reading of the statute. I won't say here from the bench, but I mean, maybe that's a fine reading of the statute to make all 18 of them pay because they all collectively instituted the action. But here, the only party that instituted the action or the proceeding is you.
Look, you know, I know that it's the position that we took below, the position that we're taking here, and the position that ultimately the district court held in ruling that the three strikes provision applied goes against at least the direction that these courts seem to be going. Certainly the Woodson case and then the Mangum case and the Hill case, although they didn't specifically rule on this point, it certainly seems like, given the opportunity, at least that panel would have ruled in this way. Our position was and is that there is a way to read this statute so that it honors the overarching congressional intent of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which was to prevent this type of litigation. Mr. Maldonado is indisputably a three-striker. By the time Judge Adams entered his order in this case, he had 9 active lawsuits against.
Well, let's assume that that's all true. He didn't file in federal court. He filed in state court.
And if the court rules that automatically eliminates the provision of 1915G, then there would be no choice but for this court to reverse and remand. I would suggest, though, that in the second part of 1915G, where it talks about what cases are we going to allow to be counted as strikes, it specifies that the cases have to have been brought in a court of the United States. The Congress made no such limitation on the first portion of 1915A when it says under no, or in no event shall a prisoner bring a civil action. If I could, I know I just have a little over a minute left. as it relates to Mr. Hill's claim, which I don't know is as interesting to the panel as the three strikes claim. There is no fair reading of the complaint or supporting documents that leads to any determination other than Mr. Hill failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. But more importantly for this court, that dismissal was without prejudice. It's my belief that even today, Mr. Hill could file a complaint where he says, I did exhaust my administrative remedies, or remain silent on the issue. But in the complaint he filed, he admitted that he did not exhaust his administrative remedies. I don't know that this is actually properly before the court, in as much as that was a dismissal without prejudice. To date, Mr. Hill's not chosen to refile, but it's my understanding that he still has that opportunity if he so chooses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Baranowski, you have lots of time on rebuttal if you want it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points. This court in questions of statutory interpretation begins and often ends with a statutory text. And Section 1915G is no exception to that general rule. And Coleman v. Tollefson, the Supreme Court, said, we have to look at what this section, quote, literally says. And what I did not hear from my friend on the other side is a plausible reading of the statutory text. There's certainly no uncertainty about what brought means. Recently, in its en banc opinion in Hover v. Marx, this court said, and I quote, brought, of course, refers to the initiation of legal proceedings in a suit. Insofar as defendants are relying on policy arguments to urge this court to depart from the text and create a circuit split, I'd like to respond to those policy arguments. 2 points here. First, it is not at all clear that defendants' argument about what Congress intended here is correct. In Woodson, the Tenth Circuit explicitly rejected the end-run argument that defendants are making here, explaining that the policy purpose of Section 1915G is not subverted by allowing a removed suit to proceed without the plaintiff paying a filing fee, because the three strikes rule is to deter prisoners from filing meritless lawsuits in federal court, and is not offended by the plaintiff pursuing a claim IFP in state courts. And the text Congress enacted is the best indication of Congress's intent. And that text, which limits Section 1915G to actions brought under the federal IFP statute, evinces an intent to manage access to the federal courts while leaving states free to make their own choices regarding the payment of fees to access state courts. Our reading of the text, which would avoid nullifying the broader access to courts provided by some state schemes, best aligns with that federalist purpose. And second, arguments about what Congress intended, even if correct, cannot override the plain text of the statute. As the Supreme Court has said, no statute pursues its purpose at all costs. And when the words of a statute are clear, this court presumes that Congress said what it meant and meant what it said.
But surely you can see the end run argument. If 1915G is designed to prevent or severely limit the filing of frivolous lawsuits by prisoners in federal court, here we are with a prisoner lawsuit in federal court, and let's just assume for the sake of argument that we have a frivolous lawsuit. If that is true, then we have an end run around the statute.
I'm not sure that I agree with that, Your Honor. I think I would note that defendants are the ones who chose to burden the federal courts here, not the plaintiffs. And I think an end run implies, you know, an intention to somehow get some backdoor into the federal courts, when I think the record here shows exactly the opposite. Mr. Maldonado has twice tried to remand this case to state court and would prefer to be litigating this in state court. And I would also note that in Miller v. Donald, where a district court says, you know, even looking beyond the text of 1915G, if we just look at the purpose there, we think we can impose these additional sanctions on someone. And this court actually said that the district court's imposition of quote-unquote 1915G plus sanctions was not a fair reading of the statute, and urged that a perceived deficiency in Section 1915G is not an invitation for district courts to improve upon the statute. And we think that reasoning applies here just as well. In short, defendants' arguments about purpose just beg the question, and in any event, cannot overcome the plain text. This court has no reason to create a circuit split on the straightforward issue of statutory interpretation. If there are no further questions, we ask this court to reverse the district court's order and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you both very much. Interesting case, well argued. We'll submit that case and move to the third case of the day, which